We're discussing the repercussions of plea deals in the justice system here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. According to the ACLU, plea bargaining takes place tens of thousands of times every day in our country. It's how more than 95% of all state and federal convictions occur. And now research by professors at UW Law School looks at the extent to which prosecutors use their plea bargaining power to preserve convictions. Have you ever taken a plea deal? What were the circumstances? It's 800-642-1234. Keith Findley is a UW Law School professor. He co-authored the paper called Plea Bargaining in the Shadow of a Retrial, Bargain Away Innocence. Keith, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks so much. I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, give us some working knowledge first of the court system. How do plea bargains work? What is a plea bargain?
So a plea bargain is a negotiated settlement of a criminal case. So the way it works is that person is charged with a crime, and then prosecutors have vast discretion about what to charge, what kind of penalties to seek, what to sort of threaten the defendant with. And then the parties engage in negotiation to agree on what the outcome will be. And that can take two forms. One form is called charge bargaining, which is where you bargain away some charges. And the other is sentence bargaining, where you bargain for a particular sentence or a recommendation for a particular sentence. In Wisconsin, judges are not bound by sentence bargains, but they can impose whatever they want. But the a joint agreement for a particular sentence carries a great deal of weight. The general theory in the literature is that, and that's what the title of the paper comes from, is that parties tend to bargain in the shadow of a trial, meaning they will assess what the likely outcome of the case would be, what the penalty would be after a trial, and then discount that by the likelihood of conviction. So for example, if the parties look at a case where the expected outcome after trial might be 10 years in prison, but they think there's about an 80% chance of conviction, an appropriate rational settlement to both parties would be a plea bargain to about 8 years in prison. That's sort of the dominant theory right now of how this process works.
Almost, I hear it's like you're wagering a bet. Like for defendants, if they have strong defenses, and even if they're innocent, they have a lot of pressure to err on the side of caution and accept a plea.
Absolutely. And it is sort of a gamble, because anytime you go to trial, you just don't know what will happen, what a jury will do. It's always a risky proposition, no matter how strong your claim of innocence or from the prosecutor's perspective, how strong their proof of guilt. You never know what's going to happen. And so you make a calculated risk, a guess as to what the outcome would be. In our system, this tends to mean that when assessing those risks, prosecutors are given particularly immense power and authority to sort of impose onerous potential consequences that enhance the likelihood that a person will accept a plea, whether they're guilty or not. And that comes in the form that over the last decades, we have seen legislatures add penalty crime after crime after crime to the statutes and ratchet up penalties so immensely. When you put that together with the fact that prosecutors have virtually unreviewable discretion about what to charge and what penalties to seek, as long as it's within the statutes, what that means is prosecutors can pile on charges and ratchet up the potential exposure far beyond what they actually want or believe would be just. But imposing immense risks that to a rational criminal defendant are unacceptable and induce them to seek ways to minimize the potential harm, whether they're guilty or innocent.
We're talking with Keith Findley, who's a professor at the UW Law School, co-authored this new paper on plea bargaining. It's called Plea Bargaining in the Shadow of a Retrial. You can join in. Do prosecutors have too much leeway to use plea bargains? How should that be addressed? 800-642-1234. Keith, let's look at your research seeming to show that plea bargaining puts people who are likely innocent under pressure to take a plea deal. Can you elaborate on your findings?
Yeah, sure. The literature has long theorized that there is what scholars call an innocence problem in plea bargaining, and that is just the very nature of the enterprise that I've just described to you is one that would be likely to induce innocent people to plead guilty to avoid the risk of even harsher outcomes. And there's some psychological studies, laboratory studies, that confirm that in a laboratory setting, people can indeed be induced to accept plea bargains to things they did not do. So what we sought to do was to examine that phenomenon in the real world, in real cases. The problem in real cases, of course, is that unlike the laboratory, we usually don't have access to ground truth. It's hard to identify who's actually innocent and who's not. So the way we went about it was to look at cases where people represented by innocence projects, innocence advocacy organizations, were seeking post-conviction relief in a case where they'd already been convicted. Now, this is not a perfect proxy for innocence because some of these people will no doubt be guilty despite their claim of innocence. But for a lot of complicated reasons that we explain in the paper, this is a pretty good proxy for actual innocence, given all the screening that goes through these cases before they ever make it to the litigation process. And so we looked at what was happening in these cases when people represented by actual innocence organizations sought a new trial, and then when courts actually granted them relief, that is, vacated their convictions and ordered a new trial. And what we found was that in these cases, cases with a uniquely high likelihood of actual innocence, and most of these are very serious crimes, by the way, prosecutors offered plea bargains in an attempt to preserve the convictions in about a quarter of the cases. And even perhaps more telling than that, when they offered plea bargains, the plea bargains they offered were uniformly extraordinarily generous. That is, plea bargains that sought to extract virtually nothing more from the defendant except preservation of the conviction. So in about 9 out of 10 of these plea offers, the plea bargain was to time served. Now, remember, which means it's a get out of jail free card to the defendant. But remember, these are largely murders, rapes, cases like this, cases where a prosecutor would never contemplate time served from the get-go. And so this is, given that trial shadow theory that I was describing before, this would seem to suggest that prosecutors are recognizing that in these cases, the likelihood of conviction at a new trial is close to zero. And yet they're still offering these plea bargains in an attempt to preserve these convictions.
But these irresistible plea bargains, how does that work for defendants of color? What about, minority and how those plea bargains look?
Well, it's probably not going to be a big surprise to recognize that this process tends to work particularly to the disadvantage of people of color. What we know from a lot of research is that at virtually every step of the criminal justice system, racial minorities are treated more harshly and are at a greater disadvantage than their white counterparts. We know that even in areas where the two racial groups commit crimes at about the same rate, the arrest rate for Blacks is much higher than for whites. Once they're arrested, the conviction rate is higher. Once they're convicted, the rate of sentence to prison is higher. And when we look at the exoneration cases, that is the cases where we know a person was wrongly convicted, once again, we see that for most crimes, Blacks are disproportionately affected by wrongful convictions as well. So this is a problem that uniquely impacts racial minorities, but we also have research that suggests that Blacks are probably at a greater disadvantage in the plea bargaining process itself, in part because implicit biases may be in place that will motivate system actors to try to preserve those convictions even more strenuously, but also because Black people tend to have far less confidence in the criminal justice system than their white counterparts, which means that the risks of going to trial look even greater to them. And so they may be, I'm hypothesizing here, they may be more vulnerable to the coercive effect of really generous plea offers.
UW Law School professor Keith Findley co-founded the Wisconsin Innocence Project more than two decades ago. He and his colleagues have looked at the power of plea bargaining in a new study. Do prosecutors have too much leeway to use plea bargains? How should it be addressed? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Keith Findley here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the inner workings of plea deals in the justice system. New research out of the UW Law School. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Jury trials in America are rare. Attorneys resolve the lion's share of cases through plea bargaining, as we've been talking about. That means the defendant waives their right to a trial, agrees to plead guilty to certain charges. The ACLU concluded last year that coercive plea bargaining has poisoned the criminal justice system, and criminal case dockets have become so overloaded over the past half century that, quote, conveyor belt plea bargaining has become the only release valve, end quote. UW Law School professor Keith Findley and his colleagues looked into the power of plea bargains, and he stays with us for about nine more minutes. Keith, we had a caller who couldn't stay with us. They want to know if coercion plays a role in plea bargains.
Well, sure. I mean, it all depends on how you define coercion, though. Under the law, a plea bargain that's coerced is invalid. But because a plea bargain involves waiver of a whole host of constitutional rights. The right to a jury trial, the right to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, the right to remain silent. The list goes on. And so the courts, in theory, want to make sure that those pleas are entered and the legal term for that is knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently, which means without coercion. The problem comes in, though, in identifying what is coercion. And what has been theorized and what I think our research supports is that pleas that look on their face to meet that legal standard of voluntariness in fact, may in reality be coercive in the sense that to the criminal defendant, the risks of proceeding to trial are so overwhelming compared to the overly generous offer that's being made that it's kind of like, the Godfather, they made an offer you can't refuse. So in that sense, they appear to be coercive.
I understand that plea bargains have surged over time, and at the same time, jury trials have become more time-consuming, more complex, lawyers drawing them out. Are there forces at work here with jury trials being this long-involved legal mechanism?
That may be part of what's going on, but my suspicion that I think is supported by the literature is that probably the primary factor that's driving the disappearance of jury trials and the emergence of the plea process as the dominant process for resolving criminal cases is the over criminalization of our statutes. That is the explosion of options that are available to criminal prosecutors. And the ratcheting up of statutory maximum penalties. Since the 70s, essentially, we have seen a political movement that has been fairly sustained until recently involving get tough on crime, which means every time something goes wrong, the legislatures create a new crime and the penalties keep going up higher and higher. The reason that causes trials to disappear is that because it gives prosecutors such an arsenal to work with. It every time we add to the statutes or add to the penalties, you strengthen the hand of the prosecutors, so they are able to charge far more than what they really want. And it allows them to ratchet up the potential penalties so high that most rational defendants simply can't take the risk of going to trial. It's a world in which, as some commentators have noticed, it's ironic that the more laws we have, the less relevant the law becomes, because it gives prosecutors so many options that the law doesn't dictate the outcome so much as does the preferences of the prosecutor.
Let's bring on a caller now. Lauren is joining us from Burlington. Hi, Lauren. What would you like to add?
Hi. I guess I'm looking at things from two perspectives. I used to be an insurance claims adjuster who handled civil cases. I am also now a mental health therapist, so I'm seeing some of the criminal aspects of it. I have a couple of clients who are involved in the system as we speak. I have two views on this, both related to that I believe the justice system is broken. I do not believe that there is justice anymore anywhere in the country. First reason, people that are innocent are having to plead guilty to things that they do not do because they are looking at long jail sentences, a chance that the jury will find them guilty anyway because of color, socioeconomic status. Second, I am aware of a case of a Facebook friend who was brutally, brutally murdered 2 years ago. There has not been a preliminary hearing, not one preliminary hearing. The victims are videotaped the killing of this gentleman. He was totally tied into a bed.
And
totally
Lauren, I want to pause here for a moment, and because I think you bring up a really good point on the role of victims in plea bargaining. What happens to the victims, Keith?
Well, victims have certain rights in our legal system, and including to be apprised of the proceedings and the nature of the bargains, and the generally speaking, the prosecutor is required to notify them of what's going on and hear their concerns. But they aren't parties in the litigation, so they are not direct negotiators in the plea bargaining process.
Keith Findley, professor at the UW Law School, co-author of a paper on plea bargaining. You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. So, Keith, you know, here we're driving at this, but if we almost never test prosecution's evidence through a trial, or like 95% of the time we don't, then how can you get at the truth of what happened in a case? What I'm really asking, what is the solution here?
Well, you know, there are a number of potential solutions, large and small. I mean, given what I've said already, probably the most effective thing, but the one that is almost politically unthinkable and would require massive shifts, is to reduce the size, the imprint of the criminal justice system. That is, start repealing overlapping criminal statutes, start scaling back potential punishments so that prosecutors don't have that overwhelming advantage in the negotiating process quite so much. There are a lot of other ways you can sort of level the playing field as well. But then when it comes to the plea bargaining process itself, there are a number of proposals out there that are kind of interesting that generally involve injecting the judicial oversight into the process a little bit more. In our system, judges pretty much take a hands-off approach to the bargaining process, and for good reasons, because you don't want the judge to appear biased or to put pressure on someone to accept a plea bargain. But there are ways to inject some judicial oversight that can avoid those risks. One of the more interesting ones that I've seen that we talk about in the paper a little bit is a system where you could impose a process where you have what are known as trial penalty caps. And what that means is that if a prosecutor wants to offer a plea bargain, he can do so. It has to be on the record. And then if the plea bargain is rejected, everybody knows the case goes to trial. The penalty that can be imposed after a trial would be capped at a certain marginal increment above what the plea bargain was.
Oh.
That way we know, everyone knows going in, that the risk of going to trial isn't just astronomical, and everybody knows what it will be up front. The incentive for the prosecutor has for offering overly generous and therefore coercive plea bargains is reduced because they know it will tie their own hands later if they go to trial. So there are things like that that can happen. In the end, what we really need as well, because regardless of what we do, prosecutors are going to remain probably the most powerful actors in our criminal justice system and certainly in the plea bargaining process. What we really need also is prosecutors to take the lead themselves, to impose some constraints on their own ability to charge more than they really want, and to negotiate in ways that are not coercive.
Keith, thank you for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for letting me talk about the research.
Keith Findley is a professor at the UW Law School, co-founder of the Wisconsin Innocence Project, co-author of a new paper on plea bargaining that will be published in the Wisconsin Law Review. We have a link, by the way, at wpr.org/mornings. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about an Army veteran who's turned to forestry and writing in Wisconsin's North Woods.
Brian Box served two tours in the United States Army in Afghanistan. Now he works in forestry in Wisconsin's North Woods. In 2019, Box wrote the essay Ghosts of War in a Wisconsin Forest for the New Republic, depicting his struggles with PTSD and the healing potential of the North Woods. I recently went to visit Box. We walked through the woods, recorded his essay, and talked about why he wrote it. A warning for listeners, the following contains descriptions of violence and self-harm.
Every day I start the shift by throwing on my marking gear. It's not as heavy as my kit in Afghanistan, just an easy 40-odd pounds with the paint. Instead of a blaze orange cruiser vest like the ones my coworkers use, I still take the old tactical vest I wore over my armor back then. See, when I first got in, I was with 1st Squadron, 4th Cavalry Regiment into eastern Afghanistan. And about a month before I was supposed to get out of the Army, they said, hey, needs of the Army, you got to stay. And I did another 16 months in the Army, and that time I was the operations assistant, so I was running the Troop Operations Center. And I had the record in the squadron for the fastest medevac ever done, 11 minutes and 56 seconds. From the time of the IED strike to the when the wheels went up and our guys were on their way to the medical center. So it's kind of crazy. You know, my first deployment, I was spending a lot of time shooting at people. And then my second deployment, my primary focus was getting all my guys home. I don't like taking life. I don't like suffering. You know, so that first deployment was kind of a wreck for me. And then the second one, I did my best to prevent that.
When he got home, Box took a job in forestry in Wisconsin's North Woods, and that's where the idea for the essay came to him.
I was working out on this timber sale that we're sitting in right now, and I was alone. I was working 60 hours a week alone, and I was having nonstop flashbacks. Thunderstorm passed through today, dropping walnut-sized hail and blowing trees down around me. I hid under a big sugar maple. And as trees dropped all around me, I realized that I couldn't remember precisely how many friends wound up in flag-draped coffins, but that more had died by suicide than from enemy action. And I was thinking about it, and I was like, you know, maybe I should put this pen to paper, at least to try and excise whatever demon I was dealing with out there. When Dave and Adrian died instead of me, my commander and gunner killed by an IED, I blame myself for years. I don't know, that was my albatross for a long time. It kind of drove me nuts there for a while. It took me a couple of years to recover after I got out of the Army, just from that high intensity, like constant paranoia, but.
Now, out in the forest, Box says he contends with post-traumatic stress on a regular basis.
Sometimes when I'm marking timber, I'll have a flashback and just stand there, staring off into space for God knows how long. I don't know if my coworkers have noticed. I tried to show people what it was like to just have that running in your head all the time. Like, that's what PTS feels like. You know, and that piece was a bit cathartic. I actually slept pretty darn well after that.
Box was also approved through the VA for an emotional support animal. His dog, Elias, is his constant companion.
Elias is, like, he's been a lifesaver. And he keeps me focused on the present. Like, when he's doing his 100-meter circle, and he's happily doing his thing and rolling in wolf scat, much to my dismay, he helps me so much. Sometimes when I'm out marking alone, I'll catch something out of the corner of my eye, get the sneaking feeling I'm being watched. Often I'll find it's a deer, a bear, or if I'm really lucky, one of our wolves. But sometimes I don't find anything, just left with a feeling of a presence. I wonder whether it's my brain injury doing something sparky, but I'd like to imagine the entity as one of my dead friends come to walk with me under the emerald canopy.
Box has served his country in combat, but he still feels he owes a debt. And he says helping Wisconsin's North Woods to survive and thrive is how he can repay.
When I was a kid, we didn't have enough food to eat. And a USDA program to feed inner city kids when the summer break was happening, that was sometimes the only meal I got that day. And the veterans programs that my mom had access to, she was a disabled vet in the Coast Guard. She got really badly injured on a rescue mission. Those programs that the American people offered to both me and my family kept me from starving. They economically empowered my mom to go and get a degree in electrical engineering, to be a successful postal worker, and have a decent life. That's a debt that I'll never be able to repay. But I'm doing my best, you know. And if I can help the Northwoods sequester more carbon, I think that will be my contribution. I'll take that as an epitaph. I love this forest. Doing good forestry is like being the pen and writing a love letter to the forest. Fate, I have learned, is a haphazard forester, marking clumps for destruction, then cutting unevenly, leaving some stems behind, vulnerable to rot. But under the right conditions, the stumps can sprout anew, and the hollowed out stems that remain can find new purpose.
Brian Box is a veteran of the United States Army and works in forestry in Wisconsin's North Woods. His essay, Ghosts of War in a Wisconsin Forest, was originally published in the New Republic. A full audio version can be heard on our website at wisconsinlife.org. If you or someone you know might need help, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 at 1-800-273-8255. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, it is the science of color. Researchers say our eye can see about 1 million different colors. What is your favorite? Do you have a question about how color is made? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the science of color creation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So a dozen years ago, a grad student was working on ore minerals in the lab and by accident discovered an intense blue pigment that eventually was the birth of the Crayola crayon called Blutiful. Andrew Smith is that material chemist and a color co-creator. He worked for 6 years with Shepherd Color Company to create pigments. What do you want to know about how color is formed? Join in at 800-642-1234. Andrew Smith, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me on your show today. I'm really excited about having this conversation.
Yes, excited about color. So give us a mini color lesson, if you will. Color is perceived as the reflection of light off an object. So what is the difference between colors and pigments?
Well, there's a lot of similarities to begin with. You know, as you mentioned, you know, color in its simplest definition is a function of light and how it interacts with an object and then how it's perceived. So you really need all three of those things in order to observe color. Pigments, of course, have color to them, or colorants for that matter. And each of those materials is a little bit different, either in its chemistry or its morphology. So that's the shape of particles. And the application of those pigments gives us these feelings and emotions and whatnot. So color is a function of chemistry, physics, and biology.
I understand that it's car colors that catch your eye. What pops out to you about the different cars on the road and when you see color in the world around you?
Yeah, so color can really elicit some interesting emotions. And it's the whole reason that companies have brands, right? They use colors and objects for their branding, because it can elicit emotions, and emotions, you know, basically cause us to make decisions. So when you see a car driving on the road and it has maybe some bright neon green tone to it, it's a new model out on the road, it can kind of generate these feelings of excitement and interest and, you know, a drive to maybe want to do something different in your own life. So it's a really fun way to kind of express your feelings and emotions.
I think I do the same double take when I look at nail polish. I could look at a wall of nail polish and just behold it for a long time. What is it that really attracts you to color and makes you just say, wow?
Well, color is everywhere. It's, you know, right now is a perfect time for color in autumn, where the leaves are changing into these bright and vibrant reds and oranges. There's some browns and rust colors. And, you know, so it's around us and in our environment every day. As we mentioned, the emotions that it can create, you know, these feelings inside, as well as, you know, the actual function of those materials allow us to do a lot of different things and have different things that we might not otherwise have as colored objects. So, you know, if you look outside and you see a rainbow, right, you just have this feeling of awe, like this is an amazing event to be able to see. And you can actually break down that into why we see those colors and why they're spread out like.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Andrew Smith, who is a material chemist, earned his undergraduate degree at UW-Stout, calls himself a color enthusiast. You can join in. How do you interact with color in your life? How big of a role does color play? What kinds of colors excite you? How much does a car's color influence whether you want to buy it? 800-642-1234. Taryn is joining us from Toma. Hi, Taryn. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. So this reminds me of this one fact my biology professor from college told us. She said that besides rods and cones in our eyes, ducks also have this kind of pentagonal prism in their eyes, and that may suggest that they see different colors that we don't see. Is there any info you have on this or any updated studies there have been recently?
Taryn, thank you for that. Andrew, your insights there on what the human eye can see in terms of color and what ducks see.
Yeah, so ducks, you know, in particular, I'm not familiar necessarily with their visual perception or the biology behind it, but you're absolutely right. Animals and humans have different biology that allows us to see different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. So the electromagnetic spectrum is basically energy, wave energy, and the visible spectrum is this really narrow band of that between about 400 nanometers and 800 nanometers. So our biology allows us to see in that range, and we associate different wavelengths with different colors, and we, you know, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and violet. So animals have a little bit different biology, and they actually can see either certain parts of that visible band or even beyond that into the ultraviolet or even the near infrared bands. So for example, you mentioned ducks. Birds, it can see very well into the UV, some birds, and they can also see some visible light. Cats, they can see primarily greens and violets, different shades therein. And dogs can see yellows and blues and violets. And beyond that, it's more or less grayscales.
Let's go to Rana now in Cameron. Rana, hi.
Hi, good morning. I think Karen perhaps was a great segue into my question or statement, I guess. So understanding that we're all animals, even ducks and humans. So in humans, then, our rods and cones, I mean, in animals, are what define our color for us. And it must be then that the differences in individual people in the rods and cones in our eyes are what we call determine the color. For example, I'll look at something and I'll say that's red. And in my mind, it's truly red. My husband will say, well, no, it's purple or it's burgundy. And that's his visual perception of that color. So is it just the difference between our rods and cones are, or how do I explain that? Thank you.
Rana, thank you. Andrew.
Yeah, so that's a really, really good point. And it probably brings up this that social experiment of, you know, do women see color different than men, for that matter? And if you look at the biology of men and women's eyes, there actually is a difference in the number of cones and rods between each of us. So, you know, some people will see exactly that. We could be looking, Kate, for example, at the exact same object, standing right next to each other in the same amount of light. And for instance, a flower would appear maybe Ferrari red to me, but it might appear crimson to you. And part of that interpretation of color is based on the biology, but also our learned associations, right? Our environment and the way that we've been raised also impacts how we perceive things and maybe how we associate certain colors with certain objects.
So a dozen years ago, you co-create this electric blue pigment named Yinmin. Can you tell us the story behind the color's discovery?
Yeah, the Yinmin discovery was really what we like to call serendipity. We were working on materials. These are complex inorganic materials, trying to develop what's called a multiferroic. And these materials are used in memory storage on the read-write devices and such. So think of a magnetic hard drive in your computer. In order to store information, you have to have this magnetic response to an electric field or vice versa. So we were studying these materials. And my advisor at the time, Dr. Moss Subramanian, guided me in a project to work on these materials based off of yttrium manganese oxide, which has some of these properties, and we wanted to enhance that. So we made a couple compositions. I did some analytical calculations. We studied it and tried to figure out if it was going to be a good multiferroic. And serendipitously, it was blue because it was a terrible multiferroic. And but it was recognizing that, you know, this material typically would be black if it's a good multiferroic. And it clearly wasn't. It had some vibrant blue to it. And so that immediately sparked this response with my advisor and I of, well, why? That's unusual. Let's understand that more. And so we made a few more compositions, and then we saw this blue intensity kind of have this really broad spectrum. And as we learned more about it, we learned that we could actually tune the blue color. And from that led to, you know, some additional studies as use for potential industrial applications for pigments.
Industrial application. How about the kids' coloring box, the crayons, the Crayolas?
Yeah, it's so exciting. My children were pretty excited. We actually visited Crayola facility and got to make some crayons that had the blue wrapping around it called Blutiful. It was a fantastic experience, but. So as we look to commercialize the material as a pigment, Crayola reached out and had interest in that and using it to color a new crayon. And at the time we were going through, this was at my time at Shepherd Color Company, we were going through getting all of the EPA approvals and all of the regulatory certifications on it so that it could be used appropriately in various applications. So at the time they actually didn't have an FDA approval or an approval for use in the application of crayons. So Crayola made it and inspired by yttrium indium manganese blue.
You did mention black pigment and Vanta black, with an ultra high absorption rate in the visible light spectrum. That's kind of come up as well. What interests you about Vanta black?
Vanta black is really unique for a couple of different reasons. On the artist side, there's a little debate going on about its use and exclusion of its use and for some people, but Vanta black is a part of a class of super black pigments. It's used to create some of the blackest or highest absorbing coatings out on the market. So to put this in context, most pigments used for coatings and plastics to get a black shade is like carbon black, for instance. And that absorbs about 94 to 96% of the light that impacts it. Vanta black absorbs about 99%, 99.5% even in some of its forms. So having that type of a black can really change what an object looks like. And the Vanta, the V-A-N-T-A, for instance, is actually an acronym for vertically aligned carbon. And so what they're doing is these are nanotubes. So they're using a process called chemical vapor deposition to control how these nanotubes grow.
Wow.
And in which they grow traps light, which means that it absorbs it and it looks even more black.
So deep into the colorful weeds. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it, Kate.
Andrew Smith, a color creator, material scientist, worked for 6 years with Shepherd Color Company to create pigments. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.